When you think of AI, what does your mind conjure? This week's guest, Josh Clark, wants you to start thinking of AI and machine learning as a design material. Josh is the founder and principal at Big Medium, a New York design studio specializing in future-friendly interfaces for artificial intelligence, connected devices, and responsive websites. My name is Dirk Niemeyer, a social futurist interested in systems that will make the quality of our lives better. My partner is Jonathan Follett, a writer, composer, and emerging tech researcher. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 2 of Creative Next, a show about future-proofing creatives in a world of AI automation. Let's get started. Pencils and sketchbooks, markers and whiteboard, pixels and code. These are the things I typically associate as design materials. They are the things that designers use to explore and ultimately manifest solutions to the problems they are called upon to solve. Whether analog or digital, traditional or modern, their form and role in the continuum of design is obvious. Less obvious is Josh Clark's framing that AI, and more specifically machine learning, is also a design material. While we see the impacts of AI on various things that impact designers, ranging from the increasing power of common design tools like the Adobe Creative Cloud to emerging platforms like mixed realities, AI itself is usually thought of as a material for software engineers. More, this renaissance of machine learning is relatively new, so we are still in the discovery phase of new capabilities and inventions. We are a long way away from standardized libraries and plugins that can be applied by designers in ways similar to the fonts, photos, and icons are today. The idea that AI is an available design material now, today, is a counterintuitive claim, which makes it all the more interesting. The idea of AI as a design material brings us to this week's guest, Josh Clark. I had the privilege of rooming with Josh at the Juvet AI conference a few years ago. What I admire about Josh is when you meet him, he is one of those people who are immediately and conspicuously one of the kindest and most considerate people you know. And while you're busy appreciating that, suddenly he says something and you realize, wow, this guy is just as smart as he is nice. We need more people like Josh in the world. So Josh's thesis on thinking about AI, and more specifically machine learning, as a new design material is original and compelling. Let's get to know where he's coming from.
I've been thinking a lot about machine learning as a design material in the last year or two. And what I mean by that is, you know, all designers work with some sort of a material. You know, HTML and CSS are design materials. Prose is a design material. Data and dense data and the visualization of it is a design material. And as with all those things, every material has certain strengths and weaknesses, ways that it wants to be used to be most effective, pitfalls and weaknesses that it has. And so in the same way that I think of a machinist or a woodworker working with a physical material and learning what it can do, what its boundaries are, I think that it's useful to think about the same thing with machine learning. But I think another aspect of it, so, you know, there's sort of the craft of working with machine learning and digital products. That's one thing. But I guess the other thing that I want to point out is simply that it is a material that's available for designers to use right now. I think that for a lot of designers, there's been an assumption that machine learning and artificial intelligence is the domain of data scientists or algorithm engineers, that there may not even be a role for designers, particularly since it's often in systems that don't resemble familiar kind of GUI interfaces. So what is a designer's role? And I think that it's becoming more and more clear to me, the more that I work with products that are powered by machine learning, that there's a huge role for designers, and it very much is a design material that we urgently need some designerly attention given to.
So far on the Creative Next journey, much of what we talk about has to do with the things that will be made from AI, which will impact the lives of people, primarily through augmentation and ultimately automation. But for designers, the impacts and potential are far more nuanced. Designers are part of the teams that make the experiences that include machine learning. So while we will be looking at new tools that will significantly impact the practice of design itself, machine learning is also core to the actual practice of design. With that in mind, Josh has a framework with five ways he thinks designers can use machine learning.
One of them, and this is really familiar, is recommendation. So just an example that I like to use for this is Slack not that long ago had a feature for their Slack for Teams, so for big enterprise organizations, that lets you search for people who are experts in something. So you could type in something like human resources, for example, and it would show the people who talk a lot about human resources. So it's more than sort of a brute force text search. It's more sort of, here are some recommendations around concepts. This person travels with this concept and this recommendations based on that. That's really closely related to prediction too, which is the second application that I like to think of. And prediction is just, you know, based on historical data, here's the thing that's most likely to happen next. It's something where the machines have seen this pattern happen often enough that there's a strong possibility that the next thing that's going to happen is X, Y, or Z. And I think when you think about this and just sort of everyday product, you know, predictive keyboards is a really kind of great example of that. On our keyboards on our phones, you know, if you're sort of typing something and then it sort of suggests what the next word will be, or in Google's Gmail feature, you know, it will suggest a word or phrase that will come next. It's just this little bit of intelligence that you can sprinkle into the application to make that better. A third application is classification, and that's really where you're teaching the machines to match an event or an object or a photo or a phrase to some sort of classification, some category. So one example of this that we see in kind of everyday products is in Google Forms, Google's survey tool, which lets you build surveys by typing in questions and choosing an answer. And it has several different kinds of formats for answers, right? It's multiple choice or fill in the blank or a scale from 1 to 5, you know, 10, 12, 13 different types, which is a manageable amount, but it's still something that you have to give some thought to. It's like, what's the best answer type to match this question? A year or so ago, Google added a little bit of machine learning to that so that when you type the question, it defaults to what it believes to be the most likely classification of that answer. And I want to sort of be clear, it's like one of the things that it's doing is it's not making the decision for you. It's just before you get to that field to make the choice, it has sort of set the smart default. It's classified your question as one of these sort of predefined, human-defined classifications of answer types. I wanted to sort of pause to say, you know, these things that I've mentioned so far, these examples that I'm giving, are pretty kind of almost surprisingly mundane. Right? There's small interventions. Oh, here's like a little prediction on a keyboard. Here's a way to make search a little bit more effective in Slack. Here's, you know, some way to sort of speed up the filling out of a form when you're making a survey. All these are almost surprisingly small, mundane, everyday examples. This is not your sentient robot butler that we're talking about here. These are just these sort of smaller little interventions. And I think that's something that's really important to understand is this stuff is ready to be used in everyday products, sometimes in small ways. I think that as machine learning becomes more and more prevalent, as we're already starting to see happen, and that more and more designers and developers realize that this is a tool that you can have in your kit, it will be as common to sprinkle a little machine learning, a little intelligence into an interface as it is to sprinkle a little JavaScript, a little interaction into a web page.
Sprinkle in a little machine learning. I like that. Josh has a lot to say, so I want to pause even though we're only through the first three of five ways he has identified for designers to use machine learning: recommendation, prediction, and classification. He points out how everyday these things are, and to that point, these three topics have been design considerations in website and software design going back to the early days. These are not newfangled approaches, merely an important evolution in the way the functions now operate. Whereas designers in the past were creating literal and static forms, now they can offer dynamic interactions which, when skillfully applied, much improve the user experience. Let's continue.
And so this is the fourth application that I want to talk about, is clustering. It is like categorization, except that it's the machines that are in charge of the categories. So in categorization, like the Google Forms example that I gave, there is this notion where humans are defining the categories and training the machines what kind of things match those categories. With clustering, you give the machines a whole bunch of information and it begins to define what the categories are. It sort of recognizes, here's baseline, here's normal, and here's a whole bunch of things that differ from normal in some interesting or like way. So this is a way that you can define, for example, you can look for crime, or you can look for illness in medical contexts. For example, is there's a system called Deep Patient, which took thousands and thousands of medical records and just pored over them to find patterns. And among the patterns that it found was it was able to predict about 2 years earlier than most human doctors the onset of schizophrenia, which is apparently a very difficult thing for human doctors to diagnose. Now, I want to be clear, it's not the kind of thing that you would ever say, hey, machines, you just take this over. You start prescribing medication and you know, doing everything that a human doctor would be. It's much more that you can use this thing to guide human attention and judgment, guide the doctor's judgment, the patients who may be vulnerable to this condition. I think one of the interesting things about this, though, is that we don't really understand how or why the machines do this clustering. So in the cases of this Deep Patient and schizophrenia, you might think, oh, this is great. This will give us new understanding into how schizophrenia works. But it actually doesn't. It just sort of, you know, it processes through all of these patient records and goes chunk, 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 ding, schizophrenia. You know, and so we don't actually know how it arrived at that result or what it saw. And even the people who created the system don't understand. So it's sort of this tricky thing of we have the information, but if we don't know how it was arrived at it, you know, is that actually knowledge? In any case, it is something that can at least focus human judgment on an interesting category or collection of, in this case, patients, but it could be customers or behaviors and behaviors around things like crime, for example, or it could be around anything that sort of is a departure from the normal or expected. So it's an interesting way that you can do customer segmentation, for example. What does the machine make of this? You know, one of the interesting things too is sort of what the machines make of us when we're at our most, I don't know, sort of creative or whimsical. I know several curators who are running museums or institutes, art collections through systems like this and letting the machines start to cluster and group them. And the machines do it in ways that are not like human curators would do. They don't match up to the formal schools of art or periods that we think about art more traditionally. But they are still grouped in interesting ways. And so at the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia, when they ran their collection through sort of an image recognition search and started to sort of find, you know, show, you know, find me, for example, artworks that map to the notion of an angel. It found things that definitely were not angels, including sculpture and vases and sort of some odd things like that, but also things that were also, you know, not exactly un-angel-like. You know, it's like you could kind of understand what it was thinking. But it will also sort of put together pieces of art that come from different things in different places. You might think, well, that's not very useful. It's not something that we can do, for example, to auto-tag art collections for the curators. But it is something that the curators actually looked at as something that was productive friction. You know, that the machines are strange and they see the world in different ways. They don't categorize things the way that we necessarily would as human beings. But that also lets us see the world in new ways that we wouldn't otherwise be able to see.
Productive friction is a useful term. Thinking back to Carrie Harrison last year and the way their AI was generating drink and cupcake recipes, it came at the problem from a novel perspective. And while there was a lot of rubbish, there was also some ingenious and unexpected discoveries. It's the same sort of productive friction. Let's continue.
The last thing that I'll sort of mention is just generation as an application, which is letting the machines actually create themselves. Some of that is, you know, as we're recording this, there was a big fascination in the last week with an app called FaceApp, which can, among other things, take your picture and age you in a very realistic and convincing way of, yes, this is what I'm going to look like in 30 or 40 years. That's an example of generation, whether it's sort of creating art or writing sentences or creating visualizations, this idea that the machines can begin to do some kind of creation. And as a designer, that's something that I'm interested in, and I'm actually already seeing the machines taking over some of the more rote production-oriented aspects of my work. I'm seeing, for example, systems from companies like Microsoft, but also startups. There's one called Wizard, Uizard, where you can take a picture of a wireframe sketch and it will generate full design in Sketch and in HTML, essentially mapping the familiar symbols of wireframes into complete design patterns. So machines, not exactly creative, but generative, starting to be able to make things on our behalf. So five applications that are very sort of disparate from very almost sort of mundane things like recommendation or prediction and getting into categorization, clustering, and generation that are, you know, sort of really interesting ways to think about how can we bring that into just the everyday products and applications that we work on today.
Clustering and generation begin to feel more like actual intelligence, where the AI is not just improving things we are familiar with in convenient ways, but providing an extra layer of processing beyond what a designer could have imagined before. What machine learning is perhaps best at is detecting patterns. Josh proposes that there are four specific things that become possible if we could detect patterns in anything and act on them. Let's learn about those now.
We can do better at answering questions that we already ask. So one example of that is the Slack interface that I mentioned earlier. It used to be, you know, it's like if I'm looking for someone who's a specialist in human resources and type human resources and would find just sort of brute force matches of the phrase human resources and things that people had posted. Now there's a thing of where it's sort of saying, oh, you know what, we're actually gonna create sort of concepts. We're creating semantic vectors around people that it's sort of like, oh, this is a person who talks about things related to human resources. So now when I search, I can search on a concept and find that. So it's doing things that are help us be better at asking questions that we're already asking and do it in a more efficient and informed way. The second thing, though, and this is where things begin to get really interesting, is that we're able to ask entirely new kinds of questions. So to come back to search again, instead of searching just for text or for concepts, we are able to search for emotion now. So imagine somebody at a call center, for example, instead of just sort of receiving things in chronological order or looking for email in a customer support center and just, you know, sort of browsing things as they come in. It's the kind of thing that you can actually now, you know, it's like look for urgent emails, you know, things that where the phrasing is urgent or angry or upset, or maybe you want to start your day in a gentle way. And it's like, I would like kind and complimentary emails. So in other words, we're able to ask new questions because the machines can understand things in new ways, advanced ways. Related to that is the third thing, which is that we're able to access new kinds of data. The machines are now able to understand all of the messy ways that we communicate, right? They're able to understand what we're taking pictures of, what our videos are of, what our speech is, what our handwriting says. All of these things that used to be completely opaque to the machines are now machine readable and understandable. And so that means that we can mind that for data and for insight on one sense, but it also means that we can sort of use those new sources of data as platforms of interaction. And then the fourth thing that we're able to do is to surface invisible patterns. And this comes back around to that notion of clustering that I mentioned before, is that the machines are able to see things that we simply can't, in part because they're able to just go through and make sense of such a vast amount of data and find patterns that were otherwise just lost in the sea of vastness that we weren't able to spot ourselves. And another thing is just that they bring a kind of a different perspective. The machines think differently than we do. They don't have the same kind of logic. They look for and can see different kinds of patterns. And so when I'm talking about being able to solve problems by finding new kinds of patterns, it comes back to, for example, that being able to sort of create the creative friction that I was talking about for our art curators who are able to kind of find new connections between their patterns, but also do things like prevent crime or fraud or identify disease, really find things that subtly vary from the norm in some way. I think one of the things, though, that's tricky about this is all of this is about this idea of that there is a norm. The machines detect patterns and variations that differ from the norm, or they predict the next normal thing. So it's all about what is normal, what is common, and how do we vary from that. The idea of what's normal, though, comes from us as people by what we feed to the machines as demonstration data. And so we see cases where Black women are misidentified 80% more than white men are. Simply because sort of like the machines have been trained in a whole different area and don't actually understand or recognize Black women, which is not a problem of the machines or of the algorithms, but of sort of the bubble or bias or lack of view of the people who are using these systems or creating these systems. The risk of this for all of the power and promise of machine learning is that it will quickly reinforce inequalities and magnify gaps because the people who are using the technology are the ones who will be able to get the most use of the technology and benefit from it. And then it gets into this very vicious and worrying cycle.
So let's step back and think about the models Josh has offered us. Recommendation, prediction, classification, clustering, and generation are his five ways designers can use machine learning. Then, in the specific context of detecting patterns in anything, which is perhaps machine learning's greatest superpower, Josh proposes that four things become possible. Ask better questions and get better answers, ask completely different types of questions, access new kinds of data, and surface invisible patterns. This is Josh's toolbox for using the design material of machine learning. And I think where the concepts come through most powerfully are in how they change the contexts of our lives. Take his call center example, where the AI's ability to understand and categorize content enables the operator to control their daily workload with a focus on the quality of their lives. This can certainly extend to more universal tools, such as email. Already, I manually manage how email is incorporated into my day. But that is a crude process at best, where I need to look at and act upon each and every one, even if that acting is only acknowledging it and then skipping it for later. An email app that is proactively directing incoming traffic and workflow around a variety of categories would make my life better. In an important way, I would be able to wag my own tail, as opposed to my damn tail of technology wagging me. Designers whose core expertise is, or at least should be, creating for the benefit of the user experience thus have remarkable potential to get to know machine learning technologies, understand their contexts of use, and lead the creation of products, services, and experiences that make our lives better in meaningful ways. More than merely connecting us to the technology, designers can now shape technology that makes our lives better. It is an exciting opportunity. Let's hear more about Josh's notions of problems that are worth solving.
And it turns out that in many cases, the machines are actually pretty terrible at some of the things that we most care about as human beings. But they're great at the things that we often don't like to do, the things that are repetitive or error-prone or kind of joyless tasks. They're really good at sort of spotting patterns that we don't spot well. So I think part of the work of design is to figure out what is the place, what is the point in a user journey where the machines can actually be helpful in showing insight that we would not have spotted with our own sort of puny human eyes, or also doing tasks that just frankly are menial or repetitive or error prone. So one example is I was working with a healthcare company who was trying to figure out how to use machine learning to help radiologists do their job better. Radiologists, of course, being the folks who look at images and x-rays to look for problems in our bodies, masses, or other problems. And much of their work is actually spent looking at things where there are no problems, right? It's sort of this huge sort of amount of work and volume of looking at image after image after image until they have something that actually does engage their expertise. And so one of the things, for example, that machine learning can do in that is to sort of do that triage, you know, obviously with a very high degree of sensitivity. We don't want to have any false negatives where the machines pass on something that is there, that is important. But the idea is that the machines can actually do a pass and bring the interesting cases to the humans, not do the humans' work, but actually do let the humans do what they do best. The stuff that the machines do best is rarely the stuff that humans do best, and vice versa. And so I think that the opportunity is to identify what are the partnerships there? And it's not just a functional thing about efficiency. I think one of the things is that we should try to be really mindful of what are the outcomes that we want with this. So for example, to keep with the sort of the medical track, you know, one thing that we could do that we could imagine as an outcome in the very near future is that if you go for a doctor's visit, the machines do the original sort of diagnosis. They take all the data, they sort of understand what the problems are, they even make an initial diagnosis. If things stopped there, that would be really abject. That would be an even worse situation than we have for healthcare, for example, here in the US, right? The opportunity, though, is sort of like, well, what if then that's when the doctor comes in and they don't have to do the time for some of the diagnosis? This can actually be about talking about the problem. Now the patient and the doctor can talk about how do you manage this issue? What is sort of the human connection of it? The patient can ask questions about this diagnosis. And so the time that was spent in sort of this analysis mode can now be given to a more human mode. And perhaps that role doesn't require quite as much education or sophistication. So costs go down and maybe we can have more people doing these things.
Healthcare has been a primary focus of AI and machine learning over the last decade. Crucially, those solutions often span beyond the domain of machine learning. Josh's examples of diagnosis are good ones, but those features can introduce much larger systems of change and ecosystem improvement. Telemedicine, a relationship between patient and healthcare system that starts at home instead of the doctor's office, has a wide array of benefits. It costs the patient less money and time. It makes it easier for the patient to initiate with a diagnostic and treatment system. It lets the doctor refocus their time away from issues of physical interaction and infrastructure into more essential aspects of the diagnostic situation. And that is the real opportunity for designers, not just to use the design materials Josh identifies on a local level, but going back to the fourth order design that Richard Buchanan talked about last episode, to extrapolate what is possible thanks to those new opportunities and reimagine larger aspects of the overall healthcare system. And finally, let's wrap up with Josh's concerns about data, the raw material that powers so much of what machine learning is capable of.
I think that the most critical thing that we have to deal with right now is just the use of data. These systems require huge amounts of data, and often the organizations that are gathering that data are companies, are capitalist companies that have a profit motive first and foremost behind what they're doing, and not necessarily the interest of the people who are gathering the data. And so I think that we're beginning to see a groundswell of mainstream concern about the big technology companies. Just as we're talking this week, the Department of Justice in the United States has opened an investigation into all of the big technology companies around sort of abuse of power, consolidation of power, and really that often means consolidation of data. I think that we have to be conscious not just of how we use data, but how as designers we can educate people to be smarter about data, to understand how it's being used and to what end. And I think that it's incumbent on us to be really transparent about how we're using data. And I don't mean that we should put it into the terms of use that you have to read, you know, thousands and thousands of words of information to be able to use a service. But as you're using it, you can see your data's effect. You can it's reporting and mirroring in some ways how your actions or behaviors are informing the model. And you can sort of see the effect just as the same way that, you know, stepping in a puddle, you can see the ripples in the system so that you understand you are affecting it at that moment. I think that that's part of it. Another part, though, is just being very clear about what bargain you're making by giving the data. And I think companies and designers shouldn't be shy about that. I think that there are a lot of times when people and companies say, well, you know, if we tell people what we're doing with their data, they're not going to want to use our service. And I think that just that should be a huge red flag, that if you are saying that, then you probably shouldn't be doing that thing. We've seen in the last couple of years how things can go wrong, how bias can creep into systems in unpleasant ways, how these systems can be used in cynical ways by foreign governments to manipulate democracy, by corporations to take advantage of people who they believe, who believe that they're customers, who are actually being served by the company when in fact they are serving the company. There are lots of ways that this can go wrong. I remain optimistic. I choose to be optimistic that I see that these are powerful tools that can be used for good and for bad. And I think that that's all the more reason why we need designers and people who really kind of care about the human experience to be involved in these things so that they don't just serve more cynical powers, because these things get away from us quickly, and things could go badly. But I think that this is a time when all of us have to choose to be optimistic and to lean into that and to bring appropriate skepticism and awareness of how things could go wrong, but also to bring a sense of possibility to these really kind of powerful and exciting new tools.
So, John, how did our interview with Josh impact your thinking about the work we are doing with Creative Next?
Well, one of Josh's comments I thought was particularly pertinent. He talks about the reasons why we need designers and people who care about human experience involved in, let's call it sort of broadly, the creation of AI-related products and services. And then he contrasts that caring about human, you know, condition with more cynical powers, which I thought was a neat way to word it. But also just the idea that we're at a point now where we're just beginning to take steps to incorporate AI into products and services that are going to shape the way we work in the future. So it's really you know, being able to give input at the beginning is so much more powerful than when something's already in production or, you know, embedded in a system that you can't necessarily shake loose.
Yeah.
So I think it's probably still a little early for designers to feel comfortable, you know, working with AI as design material. And so that suggests to me that it's probably the right time to do it. Similarly, you know, say like 1996, right? The earliest days of the interwebs, right? Not particularly a comfortable time to be a designer, you know, creating, you know, websites or web applications, you know, mm-hmm. where people don't even know what you're talking about or why they'd want to use them.
Yeah.
It's actually the right time to get involved.
Yeah.
So I liked that comment from Josh, and I thought it was pertinent.
It was. You know, for me, in terms of impacting the project, I mean, just the basic metaphor of machine learning as a material, I think, is smart. It helps to demystify AI, and also to frame it as something that is in our general purview of use, as opposed to off. Beyond our grasp. It's not just something for big companies and wizard engineers to tame as part of some elaborate show. It's something interesting, but every day that can practically impact lots of different experiences and be leveraged by many professionals. So what did Josh say that was the biggest surprise or new kernel of knowledge for you?
So I particularly liked his, you know, five ways designers can use machine learning, the way he framed that. So he included, of course, recommendation, prediction, classification, clustering, and generation. So I would say if we were going to embark on, you know, creating some kind of design material, AI design material textbook, you would probably have all of the hybrids of those, right, as well as those things individually. So you can think about how Adobe is using their Sensei AI to do sort of miraculous things in Photoshop that are both generative and, you know, use recommendation and in some instances use prediction as well, like, hey, in this photo, you know, this particular angle would create this kind of light or what have you.
It's a big magical mashup, right?
Right. So I like the sort of five core, call them tent poles, right? But then you also have all of the places they intersect. And then conversely, you also have all the places that can get screwed up. So I'll give an example from choosing typefaces, right? Yeah. So the design joke is like, oh, you know, you use Comic Sans or Papyrus, right? Because you had all these choices for your fonts and then you chose something that was horribly inappropriate. Yeah. So the same thing is true of AI. You can create models that are both wrong and inappropriate. So I think when you're looking at AI as design material, just remember you don't want the equivalent of Comic Sans. Like, you don't want to choose the thing that is going to be producing erroneous results. And right now the dirty secret is that if you don't have the right training data, or you're applying an algorithmic model to another set of data that's not sort of doesn't have the same parameters, you're going to end up with wildly inconsistent results. So something to bear in mind that there are all these capabilities, and then there are also all of their opposites, right?
Yeah, I mean, the way you frame that makes me think of the old, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. And if you screw up a font, you're communicating in an inadequate way. If you're misapplying machine learning, you could be making a decision that impacts people's lives. And we've talked about in the past, and we will on future episodes as well, about bias in these systems. And if you're applying a bias system to something that can penalize or hurt people, it's devastating. So the parallel on one hand to you know, using it properly as compared to a font is right, but on the other, it's a reminder of this is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, it's flammable.
It is very flammable. The new thing for me is a real simple one. I was not familiar with the Wizard application, and Josh mentioned it. I started to research it and just enjoyed learning more about that as sort of the next extension of how website design in particular is being automated, which was interesting and worthwhile for our guests to check out as well, I think. What did you learn from Josh that has influenced your life and how you're living today?
So another thing that Josh said sort of resonated with me, and that's the stuff that machines do best is really the stuff that humans do best and vice versa. So as you know, I really enjoy creating electronic music.
Yeah.
And that phrase from Josh caused me to, you know, just think about how I'm using the, you know, software and how I am incorporating that into my composition process. So one of the dangers of composing using lots and lots of software is you can quickly lose the humanity of the piece if you're not careful. It will sound overprocessed, mm-hmm. which is, you know, happens more often than not with electronic music. Can feel cold and inhumane. So I thought that Josh's phrase really sort of made for me a, you know, sort of cast some light on like, oh, what can I use the machine for here? And what should really remain human? A perfect example is you can quantize things so your beats are always perfect. Mm-hmm. Or do you leave some parts of it unquantized so it sounds a little more human?
Yeah.
Just an example.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. You know, the thing that I'm taking from it is that cheeky line about sprinkling AI onto things. It really helps to just demystify AI, but also practically contextualize it. We often think about AI in the context of the macro things like Watson, these huge systems trying to do massive and systemic tasks or projects. But at smaller levels, AI can be plugged into a bunch of things. You know, last season we talked about chatbots at some length as one specific application that's in wider use. But that's just one example. And I think a lot of what creators will be making in the years ahead are going to come from these smaller apps, these smaller integrations of AI that just make things better. I'm not only looking forward to that, but I'm also thinking about what might I be able to sprinkle a little AI into someday. So each episode, we finish up with a thing to think about, one question germane to what's been covered on the show today. This episode's thing to think about is, what would you like to sprinkle some AI onto, and how would it thus become an experience that is even better? Think about that for yourself, and feel free to tweet at us about it, @GoCreativeNext. Creative Next is a proud member of Civil, a community-owned platform for independent journalism. Learn more at civil.co, that's civil.co. We are sponsored by GoInvo, a design practice dedicated to innovation in healthcare whose clients are as varied as AstraZeneca, 3M Health Information Services, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Learn more at goinvo.com. We're also sponsored by Design Museum Foundation, a new kind of museum. They believe design can change the world. They're online, nomadic, and focused on making design accessible to everyone. Their mission? Bring the transformative power of design everywhere. You can learn about their exhibitions, events, magazine, and more at designmuseumfoundation.org. Our final sponsor is BIF. As a purpose-driven firm, BIF is committed to bringing design strategy where it is needed most, healthcare, education, and public service, to create value for our most vulnerable populations. To learn more and connect, visit them at biff.is, that's biff.is. Please subscribe to Creative Next on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us at Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can get in touch with us at the Creative Next website, creativenext.org, or follow us on Twitter, @GoCreativeNext. On Medium, we are partnered with Towards Data Science, where we publish articles to extend and build upon these episodes. Check out all that Towards Data Science has to offer at towardsdatascience.com. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, whom you can reach at @dniemeyer, and my partner in crime is Jonathan Follett, who is at John Follett. Thanks to our guest Josh Clark, who you can connect with on Twitter, @BigMediumJosh. Tweet to us with questions, comments, topics, guest suggestions, and include the #CreativeNext. And the home base for everything we do is at creativenext.org. We recommend you sign up for our low-volume newsletter there. That's it for Creative Next Season 3, Episode 2, but here's a clip of what you can expect to hear next time. We'll see you then.
But even in the creation, it's going to make some of the more individual pieces easier to do. So you get the creative more in a kind of a creative director mode rather than a production assistant.